WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Jazz guitarist, composer, and arranger Jim Hall died in his sleep earlier this week. He was 83. Hall was known for a subtle, lyrical playing style, a gift for innovation, and collaborations with a host of talented musicians in a career that stretched over seven decades. Critic Andrew Gilbert called Hall one of jazz's most respected improvisers, an artist who wields his guitar like a paintbrush, shaping and shading each note to achieve just the right hue and texture. Hall played guitar as a teenager and got a degree in music theory in 1955. He was an original member of the Chico Hamilton Quintet, and his 1962 album with saxophonist Sonny Rollins, The Bridge, created a stir in the jazz world. Hall went on to play with many other artists, including Bill Evans, Paul Desmond, and Ella Fitzgerald, and influence a generation of jazz guitarists. In 2004, he earned a Jazz Master's Award from the National Endowment for the Arts. He was still performing as recently as this summer. Terry spoke to Jim Hall near Christmas time in 1989. They began by listening to Hall's duet with bassist Ron Carter, Alone Together, from their CD Telephone.
Since we're coming up to Christmas, why don't we start off with the gift you got when you were 10 years old for Christmas, which was your first guitar.
It's my first guitar, right. Yeah, my mom bought that for me in Cleveland, Ohio, and we sort of paid it off a dollar and a quarter or something a week to this music store in Cleveland, and I took lessons. I think the lessons were 75 cents, and the rest went toward the guitar. So it took about a year to actually pay it off.
Had you hinted for the guitar? Did you know you wanted one?
I had this Uncle Ed, who was sort of like Willie Nelson in Ohio. He wasn't that famous, but he played the guitar and he sang country songs, and he always had nice-looking ladies around him, so I thought that looks like a good way to go.
So many musicians seem to have chosen their instrument or decided to play music because it would help you
nice
make it with
ladies,
the ladies.
Yeah. He also drank a lot, and I decided not to go that way.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you have any idea what you wanted to play?
I don't believe I did until I heard Charlie Christian, which was about 3 years later. I heard him on Benny Goodman Records, and then I knew that whatever he was doing was what I wanted to do. I didn't really know. It just seemed like a nice idea to hold a guitar and play it. So,
is it fair to say that Charlie Christian has remained your primary influence over the years?
I think so, yeah. I hadn't really thought about it quite that way, but when I hear him now on those records that I heard when I was 13, he sounds better than he did when I was 13. And I would still, I think if I could play one solo that sounds to me as complete and perfect as the way Charlie played, I would feel great. So, yes, I think he's still the Holy Grail or something that I'm looking for.
What were the early bands like that you played in?
Terrible. I played polkas and mazurkas and all kinds of stuff and didn't really know any better, and I think it was good that I didn't. because I got all that groundwork out of the way before my judgment had formed. We had a, in junior high school, there was a quartet, which was accordion, clarinet, drums, and guitar. So you can almost hear it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but the good thing about that was that the clarinet player...
A strange grouping of instruments.
Kind of standard, yeah. No, nobody owned a bass.
Uh-huh.
Accordion was very big in Ohio. And we played all kinds of stuff, probably very badly. But the clarinet player loved Benny Goodman, and that's, so it was through him that I heard Charlie Christian. And then shortly after that, I started playing in better groups. I got socially and musically involved with older guys, like in their 20s, who got me listening to Lester Young and Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster and Art Tatum. Art Tatum was a big influence, musical influence. So by the time I was, say, 15 or 16, I was pretty well gone down the jazz road there.
Well, in one interview, you said that you felt you were leading a double life when you were in high school, because on the one hand, you were the president of your class and making speeches about citizenship.
Right.
But on the other hand, you were spending your evenings playing in a saloon.
In saloons, right.
Yeah, with guys much older than you were. Well, did you feel any guilt about spending your nights playing in saloons?
yes, I did. I'm still getting over it. 100 years of analysis later. Oh, sure, the Midwestern kind of... religious upbringing and the conflict that involved. It was probably one of the reasons I stayed in music was because it was considered slightly sinful to be playing jazz in a saloon. So, yeah, there was some kind of conflict, but I loved it at that time, and I'm still trying to straighten it out.
Were you from a religious upbringing?
Kind of. Protestant Baptist, and I don't want to get into the whole thing, but some parts of the family were a little even more extreme than the Baptists, and there was a lot of dichotomy there between the music that I loved and the way of life that was supposed to be correct.
So did you get any pressure?
Is that carefully enough?
Yeah, right. Well, did you get pressure from your family to get out of that life?
Yeah, occasionally I did, but then. Gradually, I went straight for 5 years. I went to an actual music school, a conservatory, and that seemed to satisfy some of that straight and narrow stuff. Also turned me into a much better musician. It was one of the best things I've ever done. So after I graduated from high school, I went through the Cleveland Institute of Music for about 5 years. And that was terrific. And then I continued my life of sin right after that, up to the present.
Let me play the first album that you recorded under your own name, mm-hmm. you know, with your group, and mm-hmm. then we'll talk about the events leading up to it. And this is from an album that was first released in 1957 that's since been reissued on compact disc. The album's called Jazz Guitar, and Jim Hall's trio in this features Carl Perkins at the piano and Red Mitchell on bass. Let's hear Tangerine. Thank you. guitarist Jim Hall from his first album called Jazz Guitar. How old were you when you made that record?
Let's see, 26, I guess, 25, 26, 26, I think.
What were you working on?
I thought you were going to say, what was I wearing?
No.
What was I working on?
No, and you're playing. You know, what were you really concerned with?
I was just thinking about that as the record was playing. I think I probably loved Zoot Sims and Lester Young about then, and I can kind of hear that in my playing. I was around Zoot Sims a lot for a period of years, and I loved his rhythmic sense, his sense of time, and I loved Lester's melodic sense. So it sounds like kind of a combination of the two of them and a little bit of Charlie Christian. The notes were a little shorter than the way I play now. Sounded pretty good, actually. I enjoyed hearing that.
I think it sounds real good.
Jim Hall speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1989. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and we're listening to Terry's interview with jazz guitarist, composer, and arranger Jim Hall, who died Tuesday at the age of 83. They spoke in 1989.
Over the years, you've played with many different musicians, including Jimmy Giuffre, who you mentioned, Ben Webster, Sonny Rollins, Lee Konitz, Bill Evans. Some of the musicians you've played with have been black. Some of them have been white. You've played in groups of, I think, all different racial configurations. And there's been times when the group has been predominantly white with a black musician, and there's times where the group's been predominantly black and you've been the white musician. What are some of the absurdities you've run into in various configurations with how, like, the black player or the white player was treated?
Well, often when I was working with Sonny Rollins, I was hate to even get into racial things, but nevertheless, it's a fact that I was the white guy in the group, and often we'd be checking into a hotel, and the people at the hotel would assume I was the manager, whereas in reality, I was the most unmanageable one in the group. And then I remember driving cross-country with Chico Hamilton, and this was in the 50s, and Chico wouldn't even get out of the car going through the South and the West, and I'd have to go in for, you know, for food and bring it out to him. And he was the leader of the group. That was, I would say, absurd in every sense of the word. Mostly, the experiences were terrific. I wouldn't trade any of that. The peripheral business reflected the what was happening in the country and still is, I think.
After playing for years and, you know, after being on the road for years in the mid-1960s, you decided to come off the road for a while and you got a job in New York working in the band of the Merv Griffin Show. Why did you want to go off the road?
I felt I'd had enough of it for a while. I was interested in getting married. And I'm not quite sure. I think I was tired. I'd been on the road almost constantly for about 10 years. And the Griffin Show job was available, so I took it.
What kinds of music were you called on to play?
Garbage. the same people. I felt like I was, what did Yogi Berra say? Deja vu all over. Again, I had played for these nuts when I was a kid. You know, you'd play a wedding and the bride would have a cousin or something, and he'd come up and sing, and it was always bad, and they get lost. So now these guys are stars, and you're, so I did this when I was 14. That's the way it felt to me. And then occasionally, well, I got to play with Count Basie on that show. We had a big band for a while when I went to CBS. And I had never played with Basie, and I also got to play with Duke Ellington. You know, by default, we were there, we were the band. But generally, we would play while the world was watching TV commercials, we'd be playing some of our stuff. And it was a good band. Musically, it was terrific. Bob Brookmeyer was in the band, Richie Kamuka, marvelous tenor player. Jake Hanna was the drummer. For a while, we had Kai Winding. Benny Powell was another trombone player. Great musicians. But I don't even particularly want to dwell on it. It was just a bad, not something that I would, it's not what I started out to do, and I managed to get out of it.
Hmm. Well, I want to play something that you recorded in the mid-1970s. This is from an album called Concerto. And I'm going to play the alternate take of your recording of The Answer Is Yes, which is a song that was written by your wife, Jane Hall. And playing the alternate take here because it features a lot more of you. And it's issued on the CD version of the album. You want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yeah, I'm nervous. I never heard this.
You didn't? Take.
It's a tough tune. My wife did write it, and I say that because it has a difficult, the bridge on it is difficult. And I remember that Chet Baker had a tough time getting through the bridge because he didn't read chord changes. He played entirely by ear. He's a marvelous player. I'm curious to hear it.
Well, let's give it a listen.
Yeah.
An excerpt of The Answer Is Yes, featuring my guest, guitarist Jim Hall, from his reissued album, Concerto. Well, I liked it. What'd you think?
It was kind of interesting. The Roland Hanna wasn't even on that take, it sounds like, and neither was Chet. So maybe that's why we did another one. I guess that was just a trio version. I'll have to. I think I have a CD of that, but I haven't heard it yet. I sort of liked the way I was thrashing through the chord changes there. Worked out all right.
You've never been one of these, like, flashy speed guitarists.
No. I never could. Actually, I often wish that I could do that and then just not, because I chose not to. But the guitar's been difficult for me to play physically. It gets better occasionally. Like, for instance, I had to play solos in Brazil a couple of years ago, and that really frightened me. So I practiced. Every morning, I'd wake up in a sweat about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd practice till about 9, then go back to sleep. And I actually did get better. My technique got better. I got faster. I also got through the solo concerts. But I've never really had that particular kind of speed facility. I think I have other kinds of techniques that I use on the guitar, but speed has never been one of them. So that's why I play slower tempos and ballads.
Certain people have this almost stereotyped view of the jazz musician as hipster, you know, and it's an image that physically you don't fit into. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
The hipster image. Did people ever say to you, you don't look like a jazz musician?
Mm-hmm. Yes, or a number of other things, too. Yeah, sure. That's why I said people thought I was the band manager on the road.
Right, right. So how do you react to that?
I enjoy that. I get a kick out of it. If you can play, then it makes it even more fun. You don't look like an athlete, but actually you're Babe Ruth or something. That's pretty good.
Jim Hall speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1989. Hall died Tuesday at his home in Greenwich Village. He was 83. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.